From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's kind of hard to imagine now, but the law professor Tim Wu says there was a time when we had these sanctuaries where we wouldn't allow advertising or business. But I don't need to tell you, not anymore. I won't even bother to go down the list of places where you'll find a banner or a cookie or a tempting bit of clickbait. In Wu's new book, he explains how we got to this new normal. And what he's learned is that about a century ago, this new industry emerged that used your attention as a resource, as a commodity. And now, Wu says, we've just come to expect a life experience that is as mediated as never before in human history. It's radically changed and shaped how our lives are lived. Tim Wu is joining us today to talk about the business of harvesting our attention and selling it to advertisers, the attention merchants. Join us after the news.
Love what you hear? Radio West's podcast is made possible in part by thousands of KUER sustainers, along with Albion Financial Group, with more than 30 years of offering individualized attention to help clients make decisions toward their wealth management goals. Find out more online at albionfinancial.com.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In his new book, the law professor and tech writer Tim Wu describes human attention as a commodity, like orange juice or soybean oil. It's a huge industry, attention, and what these merchants do, he explains, is they harvest attention by getting you to click on something or watch something, and then they resell it to advertisers. And as you know, advertising is now pretty much everywhere. Wu points out that most of us carry devices on our bodies that constantly find ways to commercialize the smallest particles of our time and attention. And yes, he admits, we all have chosen to live this way. By scrolling and clicking and staring, we've entered into what he calls this grand bargain with the attention industry. And maybe that's fine, but Wu says it's really important that we all fully understand the deal, that this has costs and benefits. And that's what his book is about. It's about how we got to this point also. The book is called The Attention Merchants, The Epic Scramble to Get Inside Our Heads. Tim Wu is joining us today to talk about it. He's the Isidore and Seville Sulzbacher Professor of Law at Columbia Law School. You should also know he coined the term net neutrality. His writing has appeared in Slate, The New Yorker, The New York Times, The Washington Post, among others. He's joining us today from a studio in Los Angeles where he's on book tour. And Tim Wu, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, sure. Pleasure to be here.
I guess I wanted to begin by asking what it is that got you started thinking about this. You've talked about, I'm not sure if you were talking about one particular moment where you found yourself in a, you know, going down the rabbit hole, or if it was just in general you wondered. But this is clearly something that got you thinking.
Yeah, no, I think a good book or a serious project often starts from personal experience. And I just started noticing that I was having trouble controlling my own attention, and I am relatively – I like to think of myself as someone who can focus, but I had trouble. I would sit down and, you know, try to write one email, and all of a sudden, like, 2 hours would go by, and I was like, what exactly is going on? This may sound a little also ridiculous, but I went to the Utah desert for a week, and I just, like, by myself just – it was actually as an experiment to see what it would be like, just, you know, thinking. And I was like, wow, my time and attention are one of the things that's really different in this environment. So I was like, this is really affecting how we live and therefore maybe worth writing a book about.
Your previous book, Master Switch, is about the American sort of information industry. And I'm wondering how this book fits in this theme, because you've written that you're really interested in, as you put it, making apparent the influence of economic ambition and power on how we live our lives or experience our lives. Would you talk about that?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, I think our lives are almost obviously affected by economic forces and the business models of the economic power in our lives. And I wrote my first book, The Master Switch, interest in the long cycles of technological innovation and then what happens afterwards. Yeah. You know, I kind of wanted to write the book like after you invent the telephone, then what happens?
Right.
And, you know, that book was about the scramble to that period where there's, you know, openness, and then ultimately the crowning usually of a monopolist or a few really big companies who take over that industry. So, you know, I was interested in that. This book is about a different business model. It has something – a little. There's some inventions, but mostly this book is about, as you said in the introduction, the realization that a company can make money not by selling a product, mm-hmm. traditional way of making money, but by selling people to other people, by reselling the access to the minds of an audience. You know, something discovered, I think, in the early 19th century, and something just because it's us, because it's our minds, our time, that has a very profound effect on how we live moment to moment.
I also heard you once say that part of your life's mission was to fight bullies.
Yeah.
Does this fit into that?
You know, I think a little bit. You know, that's a little more related to my work in law enforcement and when I've been in government. But I think it's worth, you know, pointing out the effect of power in our lives. I have, I guess, a general distrust of centralized power, whether it's government or whether it's private industry. I think America is America's very cognizant of the danger of centralized government power. But private power, I think sometimes we have a blind spot. And so this is part of that project.
Okay. So to give us a sense of kind of the current state of affairs, you begin in the book in this school district in Central California. It's the Twin Rivers School District.
Yeah.
And they had, I guess like a lot of districts, they'd struggled financially. And so they were, you know, thinking about what they're going to do about this. And someone proposed advertising. And here's how you describe the question for the school district. If the schools could seize their attention for the purpose of educating students, you know, seize the attention of students, why not sell off a bit of it for the sake of improving the educational experience? Like, why not? We've got this thing. It may not be ideal, but this is kind of where the central idea is, it seems like. People are like, look, it's not that bad. We can do it. We've never done it before, but talk about that. Like, this is where we are now as we're talking about advertising in public schools.
I mean, I'm always interested in how something that seems really shocking to one generation becomes normalized in another. And public schools were one of the places that I found myself shocked. But, you know, reading more and more, I started to realize how this kind of thinking that it's a win-win bargain, you know, we're really hard up for money. Well, you know, why don't we just line the lockers with ads or, you know, accept some of these teaching modules. You know, it's not a big deal, and then we can have a better extracurricular program, or, you know, we're low on money anyway. So it's in this kind of creeping nature do I think that we lose control over some of what should, in my view, be valuable to us, i.e., or that is, you know, zones of privacy, sanctuaries, all based on the idea that, well, you know, what's the big deal? And it's normal. I mean, adults are always being exposed to advertisements anyway. So what's the big deal of having, you know, big advertising screens in the school? I mean, some of what and I've seen some of these are some of the advertising is these big TV screens put in the school that are flashing advertisements.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've gotten used to it because we sit in the airplane and you're exposed to
it.
But bit by bit, incrementally, you know, glacially, we lose something, I think, which is our in some ways ourselves, but in also some ways the time and space to reflect and be who we want to be. I'm sorry to go on in this, but it's not only public schools. Some state parks have started to take this direction where they've seen, well, all these people, you know, come to, you know, Utah has all these great, come to Canyonlands or Arches, and they're, well, all these people are staring at the scenery. Well, we could put an ad in there.
Yeah.
You know, there's millions of eyeballs going wasted, basically, is the logic. Yeah.
Well, you say that the stakes are really high. In fact, you say it's not about just our nation or our culture. You say the very nature of our lives.
Yeah.
Which sounds like, wow, but talk about what you mean, because that's a big part of the book, like the nature of how we interact with each other and what we pay attention to and all of those things.
So I was very influenced by this philosopher William James, 19th century writer, one of the first psychologists. And he made this point, which is absolutely true, that your life is merely a succession of what you choose to pay attention to. So when you, you know, are looking back at the last whatever years you've lived and you think, well, what was my life? It will have been what you paid time and attention to, what you processed. That is what you did. You can't do anything without directing attention to it, right? And so in a very real sense, the war for our attention, what you are deciding to pay attention to, is your life. There's nothing else. Yeah. So I mean, I guess that means the stakes couldn't be higher in that sense, at least if you and I think most of us do care about how we spend our lives. So that's the point of the book. And I guess I'm suggesting that, you know, people often spend their lives maybe in ways they feel maybe less than what they want. But we live in a world where we have an industry devoted to taking us away from what we want to do towards other goals. And I guess that's something worth thinking about.
We'll come back to this because it seems like kind of one of those overarching themes. But it seems like it's about boundaries almost more than anything else. It's not necessarily that there are people out there who are trying to capture our attention. The question is, at what point do we say, no, let's not do it in here, or let's not do it in here? Yes?
Right. I think that's right. I mean, what I think is that there was a time earlier where tradition, religion, social norms kept hard boundaries between the more private parts of our lives, the non-commercial part, and sort of the on the street, anything goes. You know, you can see this in religious traditions like the, keeping the Sabbath in Christianity and in Judaism, or even just the technological fact that, you know, 100 years ago, if you and a friend were sitting at a bar hanging out or if you wanted to hang out with your friends at all, you had to in some way be with them in a way that wasn't intermediated by advertising.
Yeah.
And,
seems
you know,
so
now
quaint.
I know, it seems funny, but there's just and now if you want to live that way, you have to decide for yourself. I mean, this is the promise and the peril of individualism, is you have to draw your own boundaries. You have to sort of be, oh, I'm going to live like an observant Jew because I feel better that way. You know what I mean? You have to sort of do it yourself. You know, some people, even I think religious people who might go to church once a week still are probably spending more time watching television, which I think is a perfectly valid choice. I just think you have to really make your own decisions and make them really hard. And you're right. In that sense, it's about boundaries.
All right. Let's talk about the history of it because it's an important part to the story. And it's interesting how you managed to kind of pinpoint the beginning of all of this roughly the summer of 1833, where you have these newspapers in New York. And the papers of the time, as you explain in the book, small circulations, and they're really expensive relative to what somebody in 1833 made, which leads us to Benjamin Day, who was kind of a disruptor.
Yes, he certainly is. In his, he is maybe the first newspaper man who's also a businessman.
Yep.
And he invented a business model which has profoundly affected our present. So as you said, newspapers in the day were expensive, almost luxury items, a little bit more like magazines, except for they were boring. They were boring. Yeah. They covered you look at them and they have like full reprints of political speeches, financial news. So they're boring and expensive. So he had this idea. He was a printer and he was like, I'm going to create a new kind of paper. It's going to be filled with really interesting, lurid stories of crime and murder and suicide and gossip and so on. Kind of the early version of celebrity gossip, so a tabloid kind of newspaper, and I'm going to sell it for a penny. Now, at that price, I'm losing money unless I get enough of an audience that I can resell them to advertisers. So he put his whole bet on the idea that his audience would be his product.
Yeah.
And in that moment, when it succeeded,
It didn't take long, it seems, to succeed, right?
No, it didn't. I think he was losing money for the first. I mean, it's not like we have really great
right.
Records of his accounting. And yet he was prone to, as we'll maybe discuss later, fabrication and
yeah, we will.
Lying. And I'm not sure. I really don't know if his circulation numbers. I mean, newspapers still lie about their circulation numbers.
Of course.
So I don't know if in 1833 they were any different, particularly his whole business model. But he at some point nailed it
yeah.
and created the first advertising-powered newspaper. And for me, it was like the Wright brothers discovering the airplane
yeah.
in terms of our media environment. Suddenly a different way was possible. And that is like the source of the Nile, I think, for a lot of that model, which he pioneered right there. It runs Facebook, runs Google, runs Twitter, if Twitter can ever make money, runs most of commercial television, runs a lot of radio. So, you know, much of our lives is affected by his little invention in the summer of 1833.
And he also struck on this idea you mentioned that of putting in front of people things or stories from which no one can look away. Like the first story I think that he actually prints in the paper is about this horrible poor creature Fred Hall who kills himself over this love, sort of the forlorn love suicide story, and people ate it up.
Yeah, you know, clickbait as of 1833.
Right.
In fact, the headline is A Melancholy Suicide.
Yeah.
And like, how can you look away from that?
Exactly.
You know, it's just interesting. There's another story. I sat and read the early copies of this newspaper, and the tales are heart-wrenching. There's like slaves who are in love and
yeah.
married, and one is sold to one family, another to another. You know, the beginnings of little stories and all these little things. He is a master, essentially, of what we would now call clickbait or tabloid journalism. I mean, he invented it.
Yeah.
So one of the things I think you learn from that early days is that the competition for attention is different than the competition for money.
Yeah.
The competition for money, you know, if you're selling cars or shoes, a quality product, how long does it last? Competition for attention, it's basically about being more outrageous, more outlandish and lurid, and gathering up a big crowd. And it started – even in the early days of tabloid newspaper competition, you could see that was the way it was going to be.
Talk about James Gordon Bennett. Was he crazy cross-eyed and
yes.
Kind of a horrible guy. I mean, he loved to sort of, as you mentioned in the book, hurl insults and start these fights. And
yes.
people liked that too, I guess. They liked the
yeah.
fighting.
It's amazing how much of the, you know, the techniques are pioneered right at the very beginning.
Yeah.
So he realized right away that if you insult people and start a fight, that for some reason audiences love that stuff, that you can insult your way to enormous circulation. He also, as you said, weird guy, former school teacher, cross-eyed, simultaneously very pious, but then very low.
Right.
He was a competitor. New York Tribune was his paper to the New York Sun. And pretty soon, he had started to surpass the New York Sun. His big thing was in-person crime reporting,
yeah.
where he would go to the scene of a murder and describe the body. And there's a very vivid scene in the book where he is looking at the body of this murdered prostitute, which was also set on fire. She was killed with an axe. And he says she is as beautiful as the Venus de Milo.
Yeah.
It's this kind of really weird thing where he's lusting after this beautiful naked body, which is also half on fire and has hatchet wounds all over it. But anyway, the audiences ate it up, and he was soon the top newspaper in New York until the New York Sun struck back.
Yeah, well, so Dave figures he's got to strike back because Bennett's now on his tails. And what's interesting to me about this part of the story is that at some point in all of this, in the competition between Bennett and Day, you say
yeah.
they had no limits. The New York Sun, and here's how you put it in the book, discarded what we would consider the paramount journalistic ethic, that of being bound by facts. So Day figures at this point, I mean, they sort of had facts. I mean, these things were kind of true, but he ditches that entirely. Talk about this story, if you would.
Although his audience didn't realize that.
Of course.
So one day,
yeah.
there's a six-part exclusive to the New York Sun, the world's largest telescope and what has been discovered on the moon.
Right.
and, you know, bit by bit, very scientific language, they have got the exclusive findings of what's on the moon. And it kind of starts modestly. There's trees, lakes, giant mountains. But then they discover unicorns. And then in sort of the finale, they discover man bats roaming the moon, never discovered before. So that's this series. People go crazy, obviously. And it's never retracted.
Yeah.
Nobody knows it's not true because how do you disprove it? So, I mean, imagine if, you know, the local paper just said life on Mars. I mean, we would be going nuts. And in fact, we already go nuts when someone found some bacteria on Mars. never retracted. So that was his strategy. He started deviating increasingly from the idea of fact and managed to, at least for the short term, become the most popular newspaper in the world and I think prove both that the model works, that you can make money. He made a lot of money mm-hmm. at his newspaper, very sort of the first person to do that, you know, that essentially the media can be a business that is a real business. So in a way, he's kind of the ancestor of all the media tycoons from, you know, Rupert Murdoch, Ted Turner, you name it, the businessmen who are in media. Before that, it wasn't like that.
Yeah.
And then also show some of, I think, the perils of the business model.
Tim Wu is with us, professor at Columbia Law School. His new book is called The Attention Merchants, The Epic Scramble to Get Inside Our Heads. We'll take a quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about your attention span. And think about it like a commodity, Tim Wu says. You have these merchants who harvest your attention and resell it to advertisers. It's a massive part of our economy. It used to be a time when we had sanctuaries from commercials and ads, but not really anymore. And Wu wants us to understand why, how we got to this point, because he says it's transforming human interaction. His book is called The Attention Merchants, The Epic Scramble to Get Inside Our Heads. He's joining us from a studio in Los Angeles to talk about it. All right, let's talk about posters. It's sort of the second milestone in the story. I loved this part of the story. These posters in – this is 19th century – France, Paris, France, basically.
Yeah.
But talk about this part, because I think what's interesting about this part, not only the posters sound great, but that the Parisians revolted, and that's a big theme
yes.
in the story.
Yeah, no, there's a lot going on in the poster. The invention of the poster is an event with enormous long-term consequences as well. And what the Parisians did is poster creators was make vividly colorful graphic posters that were almost impossible to turn away from.
Yeah.
They would attract your mind so definitely that it was, as people said, like, you know, your brain had become captured by them. And you've probably seen them, you know, if you ever, well, either go to Paris or if you look at these old ads, people collect them, either they're usually for alcohol or Moulin Rouge or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, you see them around. They're fascinating because in some ways they're, I think, the ancestor to the screens that we spend all our time looking at,
yeah.
you know, with the sense of motion. They didn't actually move, but they looked like they moved. They feed, we'll maybe talk about this in a moment, into government propaganda mm-hmm. pretty quickly.
Yeah, we'll get there.
But I also want to talk about what you said, is that we saw with the arrival of the poster in Paris also one of the first revolts against advertising. You know, most people dislike advertising, unless you're in the ad business. And one of the features of our history is a periodic revolt when things go too far. And in Paris, posters were everywhere. you know, you look at pictures from the time and there's not a square surface of anything not covered in them. And this group, Les Amis de Paris or something like that, excuse my pronunciation, but they get together, the Friends of Paris, and they say, if we want to defend what Paris is all about, we need to regulate or ban the poster. It's unethical, it's unaesthetic, it's terrible. So they did, and you see one of the first times that you have what we now consider you know, regulation of advertising. And those revolts, I think, stay around, and we'll get to this later, but I think we may be in a revolt right now as we speak.
Well, it seems like you take hope in that Paris example, because the limits that the Parisians imposed like more than 100 years ago, they're still in place. So they can – these kind of revolts or the effects or these backlashes, seems like what you're saying there is that they can be long-lasting. They can stick around.
Yeah, and the cause for optimism in my book is that, you know, when things go too far, we occasionally – do revolt or do something about it. You have, for example, the limits in Paris, and I think Paris is still a very beautiful city, partially because they just don't have billboards everywhere. They've done a good job. There's a revolt against patent medicine in the late 19th century. We may not have time to talk about it, but, you know, snake oil mm-hmm. was discovered, and there was New Truth in Advertising laws saying, well, you can't just have a product and pretend it cures every disease and fool people with that. And so there are these moments, and I guess I take some optimism from them, although I guess I would say on overall the pessimism outweighs the optimism, but yeah. the optimism to the degree it is there is in this capacity we have for revolution.
You say that the neuroscience of attention has made a lot of progress, but it's still, you say, really too primitive to explain the harvesting of attention.
Yeah.
So what do we – and here's one thing you say is you say scientists do understand that the human brain has this incredible, magnificent power to ignore.
Yes. So while researching this book, I spent some time in a cognitive neuroscience laboratory that studies attention. It was a rewarding experience. And what you learn from that is just how scarce attention is that we are constantly bombarded with, you know, billions of bits of information, so to speak. And we just pay attention to one tiny stream. I mean, if you focus for a moment, you can move it around. You can listen to my voice. You can choose to, I don't know, see how the bottom of your feet are feeling right now. You know, if you have a sharp pain in your stomach, it'll go there. So your attention is like a little cursor and it wanders around. And that's what everyone is trying to get at. That's the purpose for all of this advertising, for so much media, is to get that cursor, even for a small moment, to direct towards something. That's why you get these thousands of messages in your inbox or little flashing ads.
Yeah.
They just want to get that cursor for a second. And that was the brilliance of the advertising posters we just talked about, is they were so
right.
brilliant and fascinating. So, yeah, it is
it seems like it seems like we
lot,
have
yeah.
no control. Like we have no actual control over whether we engage in that thing or not.
You know what I would say? It's that we have imperfect control.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a mixture of involuntary and voluntary measures. If they're were to be an explosion in the street outside, we would all pay attention to it without uncontrollably, loud noises or, you know, if a tiger suddenly attacked me, I wouldn't keep talking to you. You know, there's things that automatically move the attention. But our voluntary attention is a very fickle thing and very, very strange. You know, sometimes we talk about being distracted, and that refers, I think, to the fact that it's hard sometimes to keep your mind where you want it to be.
Right.
If you've ever sort of tried any form of meditation where you try to think about one thing for more than 30 seconds, you find your mind just kind of starts slipping around. On the other hand, humans are also capable somehow of incredible focus. Mm. You know, we can sit there and binge watch, you know, 10 Netflix episodes in a row. I mean, pretty entertaining. Or we can sit there. I mean, some people sit and work on, you know, like putting a model ship together, yeah. or on something like writing a book, or playing an instrument, and you know the hours can go by in a very deep state of focus. Part of why I wrote this book is that I am concerned about our ability to get into that mental state, actually. I think it's some of our highest functioning is when we're quite focused and deeply involved with things, whether it's, you know, as I said, gardening or playing an instrument or writing. And I believe we've created an environment that makes it harder and harder to be like that. I think it's like we're trying to write poetry in the casino these days. And, you know, it's, yeah, I mean, okay, yeah, I'm going to try and even at work, I don't know if anyone has this experience. You try to, you know, work on your job and then you spend, you know, half your time, I don't know, on the Twitter, on Twitter, Facebook,
totally.
Something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this. When you were in the Utah desert, how long did it take you to find a place where you could focus? Did that take a while?
That's a good question. I think I started to notice after the second day that I was experiencing live, second or third day, things very differently.
Yeah.
You know, maybe because it's such a novel place to be. I was in Canyonlands,
yeah.
Somewhat remote part of Canyonland, Utah. And by the way, my one of my favorite parts of the world. And I think it's when I felt that what I would have called a day felt more like a week. You know, that just time was going by in this different way. And anyway, anyone who spends a lot of time in nature knows that we begin to process things differently out there. And you realize that while we know we live in a slightly artificial environment, it is in particular with our attentional facilities that the environment is artificial, that we're constantly being prompted to pay attention to things.
Yeah.
While in nature, it's a lot different. It's hard to explain exactly what ways, but it's just different.
I want to jump ahead just a bit because while we were talking about this question of whether or not we have or how much control we might have over the things we pay attention to, you tell this really fascinating story about the sort of the, as you put it in the book, the rise of clickbait. And I think people know who Jonah Peretti is, maybe not, former school teacher. But this is back in 2001. He's at MIT.
Yes.
Would you tell the story?
Sure. I'll try and get it right. So Jonah, who ends up being a very significant figure in our present, was then a grad student, as you said. And it was, you know, randomly surfing around the World Wide Web, to use 1990s vocabulary.
Right.
Surfing the web.
Right.
People, I think we still say that sometimes.
Sort of. We old people do.
You know, that was like the phrase. And
yeah.
He found this Nike customize your own shoes site. And he was kind of a jokester. His whole career is sort of, he's very successful. You're going to
he's
see
the guy that brought us BuzzFeed, yeah.
And Huffington Post.
And Huffington Post, yeah.
So he's a, but he's always kind of a trickster, jokester kind of guy. And so he wanted a pair of shoes that said, he wanted sweatshop on his Nike shoes.
Yeah.
Nike refused the request. He got in a back and forth with customer relations. What's wrong? It's not slang. So anyway, he sent that up, put it up on the web. And forwarded it to a few friends, and then they forwarded it to friends, they forwarded it, and all of a sudden, you know, this was, of course, 15 years ago, we didn't have this phrase, it went viral.
Yeah.
So that phrase didn't really exist. And that kind of defined Peretti's career, because he was like, oh, I want to understand the science of virality. I want to create content that just makes people click on it and have that be my thing. And so the Huffington Post, to some degree, was founded on that idea, although it was also founded to be a political counterweight to some of the right-wing blogs. And then ultimately, BuzzFeed was just designed only for the purposes of trying to get people to click on stuff and share it.
Yeah.
Nothing else. No regard to content. Just let's see what we can do.
It's like Benjamin Day, who he had no like ideological intentions. He didn't really care about social order. He was trying to make money. And it seems like Peretti's that same way. He would just, all he was interested in is just, as you say, he was interested with content that was nearly devoid of any meaningful communication, that the medium was just the message. And that's all he cared about.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, the only purpose of clickbait, it's kind of interesting, is to get you to click on it.
Yeah.
And then maybe share it with people. It doesn't really seek to communicate in the way that we usually understand communication. It just seeks to achieve that function. It really, in that sense, almost is like a virus in the more malignant sense that it – and I haven't just – it happens. I think clickbait is really hard to resist. Who here in this audience has not at least once found themselves somehow like click – even like, why am I doing this? But watching your hand move over to click on something – you know, oh, look what, I don't know, whatever celebrity from the 90s looks like now.
And right.
Somehow you just can't control yourself.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, okay. You know, it's too, like a melancholy suicide, the one we started with.
Yeah.
And the funny part is there's, yeah, as I said, nothing, no other ambition than the click.
Tim Wu is with us. His book is The Attention Merchant, The Epic Scramble to Get Inside Our Heads. We'll take another quick break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Tim Wu. We're talking about his new book, The Attention Merchants, The Epic Scramble to Get Inside Our Heads. So there's another really important part of this history. It's not about the commercial application of attention harvesting. It's the application in support of government, basically war propaganda. And this part of the story you tell starts in Great Britain.
Yes.
Let's talk about that. Let's start with the Lord Herbert Kitchener.
Yeah, sure. Kitchener, a very famous figure to British people, I think less to Americans.
Yeah.
Important because I think that most people don't realize that Britain invented propaganda in the sense we now understand it. That before the British entry into World War I, there wasn't this sense of systematic propaganda, government advertising to people to do what it wants them to do. Sorry, to try to get them to do what it wants before then. So if you return to August of 1914, Great Britain declared war on Germany. They, however, lacked something essential, namely an army. Well, Britain had an army, but it was about 100,000 people. The German Imperial Army was some 4 million strong, and it just conquered Belgium. So Lord Kitchener, who was the minister for war, we would call him defense secretary in the United States, but in England was the minister for war, realized he had a serious problem. In England, the tradition, or in Britain, the tradition was against conscription or the draft, and so he had to raise an army, and he turned to the device of propaganda. And in fact, that famous poster you've probably seen, I Want You for the Army.
Yeah, Uncle Sam.
The original version of it is Lord Kitchener pointing his finger.
Yeah.
It's pretty dramatic. I Want You for the Army. And what he did was take the methods of advertising that were just being developed and turn them into a mass scale. So everywhere you were in England or Britain in 1914-15, was covered in posters. There were rallies, recruitment rallies all the time. Of course, it wasn't radio then or other mass media, but there were pamphlets, there were books, there were, you know, social movements. And he managed to get a million people, more than a million people, to join the army, even though, even from the early days, it was pretty clear you join the army, good chance of being killed or permanently injured. So that is the first. And one thing I'll say about that is, in a way you could say the British government helped invent modern advertising because it proved that it really worked.
Right.
And before that, there had been doubts. I don't know. Is it really worth it? But the British government proved beyond anyone's doubt that if you can get a million people to go to war, get themselves shot out using a bunch of advertising poster, you know, there's something here.
It's interesting. Say something maybe if you would briefly about George Creel. So he's this American newspaperman who basically adapts these British propaganda principles for the United States. And this idea that, as this French philosopher said, that to succeed, propaganda had to be total. So, that was really interesting too.
I know a lot of Americans are maybe less aware of the particularly American history of propaganda. And World War One, George Creel, the man you mentioned, appointed by President Wilson to run propaganda for the British war, American war effort, copied the British effort, but just increased the scale dramatically. You know, like all
– like good Americans.
Good Americans. Yeah. It was like big time and moved into the movie theaters, had people read war messages, pro-war messages at the breaks between movies. They had – those days they had breaks between the reels and movies. So they had people read a pro-war message for 2 minutes, local members of the community, and created this enormous bureaucracy to do so. Not only that, I mean, it gets worse than that because he also pushed and other people in government pushed efforts to arrest all the anti-war dissenters. So the First Amendment back then wasn't the way we think about it now, you know, real defense of free speech. It was not very effective. And they managed to put in prison most of the most serious dissenters against the war, you know, vocal dissenters for, you know, various forms of treason or sedition. And the American propaganda effort, World War One, was just, you know, next to the British, was the most was really quite startling.
There's this really interesting section in the book where you talk about the role of like women in advertising and demand engineering. The section where no longer you say was advertising kind of casual or improvisational. You have these advertising companies who are sort of looking to kind of the science of advertising for and this brings us, you know, and women are sort of folded into this part of the story, which I find in interesting ways. Say something about that part.
Certainly. So in the 1920s, I think in some ways our present was invented, at least in the sense of there being an advertising industry that was professional, systematic. As I said, inspired by government propaganda's successes and took very seriously the idea of trying to what they called engineer demand for products that might not have demand otherwise. Right. You know, we had a capitalist economy producing goods. Someone has to make people want these goods, and they saw that as their mission. And they weren't, like, shy about that. They were like, that's what we do. We are scientists. We make people want stuff that they wouldn't otherwise want. You know, there's a lot of examples. I'll just give one example. Mouthwash. You know, no one had heard of mouthwash before the 1920s. But in a campaign directed at women, also men. Mouthwash, actually, Listerine had, I think, been a floor disinfectant.
Right.
A battlefield, you know, used in battlefields for wounds. You know, there it was. The idea that bad breath was going to ruin your life became a very serious point of their advertising campaign. And they targeted women in particular with the figure poor Edna, who was many times a bridesmaid, never a bride. She was approaching the age of 30 without having found a husband. And it was because she had bad breath, but nobody would tell her. So problem and solution, Listerine.
Right.
You see a pattern, I think. You know, writing this book, you learn, writing or reading this book, about essentially how the act of sales and advertising works. You know, step one, gather a huge amount of attention by being outlandish, outrageous, big picture, something that gets people. Because you have to get people to pay attention somehow to begin with.
Yep.
And then once you've got it, target a very deeply held fear or concern or emotion, maybe even unspoken, and then promise to solve it. You can see that everywhere, even in contemporary politics. I wasn't going to talk about the current election, but you can see a little bit of that in there as well. That's the repeated pattern, and that was the 1920s. You asked about women. Sorry, we can get back to this. The 1920s is also what I call the first targeted advertisements, the idea that some groups want different things than others. And the first group was women.
Right.
People noticed, oh, you know, women buy things and make decisions, and maybe we need to advertise to them in different ways than we advertise to men. And that was the beginning. Usually the way women were advertised to is even more manipulative and and shaming. That was basically the approach. But anyway.
Well, and manipulating suffragettes that's a really interesting part of the story. I want to sort of move forward. There's this really crucial moment I want to ask you about that comes in, I think it's 2000.
Yeah.
So Larry Page and Sergey Brin had – this was in 1998. Like, this was before 2000, and they had been writing about – obviously, they're the founders of Google, and they're – and they have this idea that advertising is inherently corrupting.
Yeah.
And they have to make this call. They have to make this decision about whether or not – and I'm just wondering how crucial that moment is when they decide – maybe we'll give advertising a shot. Would you just talk about this? Because this seemed really important in the scheme of things.
Oh, I think this is the moment that the path of the web gets set in a fundamental way. So Google is this terrific new company. Its founders both despise advertising. And as you said, they wrote in this famous paper of theirs, the paper that announces the Google search algorithm, they write in an appendix that any search engine that relies on advertising will be inherently corrupted against the interests of its users and towards the interests of advertisers. So it's extremely dangerous. And, you know, a lot of computer geeks and tech people had always hated advertising. It seemed as very suspicious. Well, here's the moment. Google is this bright young company but is losing money like crazy. They need to do something. And they decide to swallow the bitter pill to make the deal. But they do it in this very Silicon Valley way. You know, having spent time in Silicon Valley, I recognize this, which is you believe you can eliminate the problem. You know, there was an ethical problem. They knew there was an ethical problem relying on advertising. But they thought, you know, maybe we can kind of code our way around that problem. Mm. And their idea was, well, we're going to invent advertising that isn't intrusive, that is what you want, and so nobody will mind. We're going to kind of – it's like drink Diet Coke.
Yeah,
it's,
right.
You know, all the taste, none of the calories. Yeah. So that dilemma between what tastes good and what is fattening, we can erase it. Mm. You know, there's that Silicon Valley often has that idea. It's like we can square the circle. This age-old dilemma is obsolete. So, you know, they did the deal with you know, the sort of Faustian bargain against this thing which they'd hated advertising. And I think, you know, in the early days, frankly, Google was in fact not that influenced by its advertising business model. And so for a while, it seemed like they had
pulled it
somehow
off.
Beaten it, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, squared the circle, dieted, and then it is only, you know, later, and frankly, I think now, where the demands of Google to constantly increase its advertising revenue are there, where I must imagine the founders are like, maybe we should have also explored a pay model or, you know, gosh, this is putting us in a little bit of a box. But, you know, at the time, it seemed like they could do no wrong. They did have access. I mean, it made sense, this model, because what Google delivers is access to your mind at a very important moment when you are making a decision. So if all of the attention merchants sell access to the mind, selling access to the mind when it makes a decision is like the most valuable.
Mm. Well, you point out you don't think the web has gotten worse, not better. It's kind of in a desperate state. And there's this here's a question that comes from my producer, who he has this friend who argues that the convenience of stuff like Facebook and Gmail is, you know, worth the cost of selling their data and worth the cost of the loss of control, and that it doesn't really significantly affect this guy or impact his life. And the producer's like, I feel like he's wrong, but I'm not sure what the argument is against that. What do you say to that trade-off?
Oh, sure. No, that's right. Well, I'll say more than one thing. So the problem look, I'm not against advertising in some universal sense. That there's no such thing as an advertising model. I think there can be good deals. You know, Google might be one of the better deals because Google Maps is such a great product, and, you know, search is pretty good too. So it's not like there's no such thing as a good deal. What I think the problems are is, first of all, we don't really have an option. I mean, Google, if we paid for it, would be less than $12 a year.
Yeah.
So think about that. You know, all this information, yeah, maybe it's a good deal, but how do you really feel about someone reading all your emails and all this? And maybe would you rather pay $10 a year and have all of that as well? You know, they could do it that way. So one is you have to compare it. The second thing is it's not always just the advertising. I mean, it can be a fair deal, but advertising influences – the underlying content. And I think the clickbait is no better example than clickbait. The web was, I think, once sort of a more thoughtful, kind of amateurish, but at least folky place for content. There's some of that still around. But the pressure of the advertising model has moved everything to be shorter, to be insipid, to just get you to click. And that's the danger. The danger is not so much that you're watching too many ads. It's that the underlying medium becomes corrupted.
Yeah.
And we've reached a time where television has started to look smart compared to the web.
Right. Right.
You know, and, you know,
it seems
I
like
I don't
that's
know
the
quite...
alternative, like quality. Yeah. And these subscription services, that seems like people will – I'm heartened by the fact that it seems like TV has never been better, like good TV.
Yes.
And that people are willing to pay for it. That seems heartening in some ways.
Yeah. I mean, one thing I think I've learned is and what you need to learn from this book, there's a big difference between ad-supported media and subscription. And, you know, maybe people knew this all along, but we're rediscovering it. And if we want people who are techie, people who want the web to be better, to serve them more, should want subscription paid models to start to increase and somehow work. Because, I mean, yes, okay, so Google is a great company, but it's not getting better for us. It's getting better for advertisers.
Right.
You know, Twitter and Facebook, all these sites, they have no longer really – they've sort of stopped improving themselves and started trying to figure out ways to – trick you into clicking on more stuff or get you at different points in your life. And, you know, that's kind of – I don't think the people working at those companies love that either. You know, they'd rather be building great products that work better. And so I think we've hit kind of a ceiling on the web, and unless we manage somehow to get better business models, it is going to continue to decay as a medium. And I think that's quite sad for something that was once so promising.
Tim Wu. His new book is called The Attention Merchant, The Epic Scramble to Get Inside Our Heads. He joined us from a studio in Los Angeles. Tim, thank you very much for taking the time.
Oh, that was a great conversation. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.